Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpey and Peter Torpey.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. This week is part one of a two-part interview we did with a person who has been a real leader in the field of access technology, and I'm sure people will recognize many of his contributions and have maybe even taken advantage of them.
Jim Fruchterman is the founder and CEO of Benetech. This week, we'll talk with him about how he became involved in using OCR for the blind, the story behind Bookshare, and his continuing interest in accessibility and advocating for social rights. And next week, we'll talk with him more about the worldwide impact of Bookshare, even beyond helping people with print disabilities, as well as some of his other initiatives. But first, for our tip of the week. This week's tip is, following your dreams and passions can have a huge impact on your life and that of others.
And as we'll hear, Jim's story is a great example of following your initial dreams. He had a vision when he was an undergraduate of something that he wanted to do. Well, at the time, what he wanted to do just wasn't feasible given the current technologies at that time and the resources available to him. But he kept that in the back of his mind, and as you'll see, this popped up into a real interesting venture later on in his life.
And many of our listeners are probably making use of the results of that work every day.
So if there's something that you're driven to do, it may not be possible now, but just keep it in the back of your mind, wait for the right time, and sometimes opportunity's door will open for you.
Let's start by letting Jim Fruchterman introduce himself.
Hi, I'm Jim Fruchterman, founder and CEO of Benetech, the nonprofit tech company here in Silicon Valley that develops products for people with disabilities and the human rights movement. I've been doing this now for over 26 years.
Jim didn't actually want to say much about himself, so we went to Wikipedia, where there's a lengthy entry about him that begins by saying that he is an engineer and social entrepreneur. He is the founder and CEO of Benetech, a Silicon Valley nonprofit technology company that develops software applications to address unmet needs of users in the social sector. He is the recipient of numerous awards, including the MacArthur Fellowship and the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship. He was born in Washington, D.C. and grew up in the Chicago area. He received a bachelor's degree in engineering and a master's in applied physics from Caltech and went on to Stanford University to pursue a PhD, but left school to join the Percheron Private Enterprise Rocket Project as its chief electrical engineer. The rocket blew up on the launch pad, but it launched Fruchterman's career as a serial entrepreneur.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. 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 Success.
This week's focus topic is using optical character recognition to benefit people with visual or other reading impairments.
So before we talk about some of your more recent ventures, Benetech, Bookshare, etc., maybe you can give people an idea of how you got involved in OCR in the first place. Where did this all start?
Certainly. I think the idea for making a reading machine for the blind came to me when I was still a college student, and I was in a modern optics class at Caltech, and the professor was talking about making an optical pattern recognition. Since it was the 70s, the example was a military example, how you could make a targeting system for a smart bomb that had a video camera in the nose and how it would recognize a tank in the battlefield or a bridge, whatever your target might be. And I went back to my dorm room wondering, is there a more socially beneficial application of this technology? And then I actually came up with what I called my one good idea from college. I said, well, instead of recognizing tanks in the battlefield, maybe we could recognize letters and words and read to blind people. And I actually sketched out a design, ran back to my professor the next day and said, hey, I've got this cool idea. And he explained that it was technically feasible but quite expensive, that he thought that our national security agencies already had this technology, but it cost millions of dollars. And so I walked out of there going, wow, it was a good idea, not practical right now.
And as an indication of just how difficult some of this pattern recognition technology was, about 20 years later, I was at a conference and the speaker before me was talking basically about how far from random the image could be of what was in front of you so that you could be positive that what you were about to shoot was a tank or not. And I, of course, being in corporate research at Xerox, what we cared about was the quality of the report written on the subject. And I was talking about how far from perfect the quality of the report, not its content, but what it looked like, could be before anybody could tell that it wasn't a perfect image. So it was an interesting dichotomy. So Jim, after your advisor informed you that your great idea was impractical at the time, you must have kept that in the back of your mind for quite a while.
Years later, after doing a few things like blowing up a private rocket, it was one of the first private enterprise rocket companies, my former boss from the rocket project said, hey, I have a friend who is a chip designer and he wants to make a chip that can read anything. I went, wow, you could make a reading machine for the blind with that. That's like my one good idea from college. And so that's how we started Calera Recognition Systems. Actually, it was originally called the Palantir Corporation, but eventually we had to change the name. And our idea was to make an OmniFont character recognition technology that would solve commercial problems like scanning in contracts and forms, but also help blind people. And we went off and invented that technology. And then there was the moment of truth when I tried to do a product for the blind.
So this was in the early 80s, and this was probably one of the first attempts at doing OmniFont recognition, right?
That's right. So we founded the company in 1982, and it wasn't the first attempt. I mean, at the time when we started the company, Xerox, who had bought Ray Kurzweil's original company, had a reading machine, had pretty much the leading reading machine that existed. Telesensory, which was an early technology company for visually impaired people, had just shut down their reading machine project, like right before we got started. But anyway, they were someone who was also working on it. But our core thing was to invent the technology, which took us a number of years. And then we built a secret prototype reading machine for the blind in the mid-80s, say maybe 86, showed it to our venture capital investors, and we had a successful demo. It was, a Calera scanner reader that did the scanning of the page and the OCR and connected to a first-generation PC and a first-generation Votrax voice synthesizer. And after the demo worked, the board said, so Jim, what's the market size for reading machines for the blind? And I said, well, I think Xerox is selling about $1 million per year. Dead silence in the boardroom. And finally someone said, and the connection to the $25 million we've invested in this firm is what exactly? And so they vetoed the reading machine for the blind project because it wasn't going to make enough money compared to the amount of money they invested. And, they were, from a business standpoint, correct. It wasn't going to make enough money, and we had promised to make them a lot of money to get their $25 million. But it was socially, I thought, wrong. So a couple of years later, we went through one of our periodic CEO changes. That's what venture capitalists do when you're not making quite as much money as you promise. And the guy we hired had been the general manager at the Xerox unit that had the Kurzweil reading machine. And 2 months after he arrived, I walked in and quit. And he said, oh, don't quit. Don't hire away all our engineers. Don't compete with us. And I said, I'll make you a deal. You let me set up, a nonprofit tech company that makes reading machines to the blind, since you guys won't do it. Give me a really good deal on the product. Give me credit. And I promise not to hire away anyone for at least a year and not to compete for at least a year. And also, I set up a separate company to go after high-end OCR like the Postal Service. So I set up both the for-profit company and the nonprofit company in early 1989.
So that was a great arrangement with Calera. They obviously enabled you to license the technology from them to start a business that wasn't competing in their field.
Yeah, I think once I changed the ask from let's build this product inside the company, and the venture capitalists were mainly worried about us distracting the team from making money because we were not making money. Once I said, oh, I'm leaving, I'm signing a non-compete, and can I please go off and do this outside the company with your technology, they were quite supportive, actually. And because, you know, I think they were quite proud that the technology could be used to help blind people. They just didn't see it as a very interesting business case. And you know, it turned out that instead of being a $1 million-a-year business, it was a $5 million-a-year business within, I think, 3 years.
Wow.
So it, you know, exceeded expectations. But even $5 million a year would never have, you know, gotten venture capitalists in Silicon Valley excited. So a $5 million a year break-even social venture was a giant success for the nonprofit world and still a flop from a for-profit Silicon Valley point of view.
There are all sorts of rules about what a company needs to do and be in order to qualify as a nonprofit, especially to qualify for tax-exempt status. And really, the bottom line is that you have to have a completely different mindset. A regular corporation, the whole point is to make money. And like Jim said, you know, their parent company really couldn't afford to do what he was trying to do. And thank goodness they let him use the technology in his own nonprofit to do what he did. Now, according to one version of your bio that I just read, you're still providing OCR to the Postal Service?
That's correct. Yeah, I was CEO of both Arkenstone, the original nonprofit that's now called Benetech, and RAF Technology, which is short for Ross and Fruchterman, which is a leading OCR company. I was CEO of both for 6 years, but in 1995, both Arkenstone and RAF had grown to the point where I had to pick one, and I picked the nonprofit. I was having more fun. And then I was the chief financial officer at RAF for another at least 5 years, and now I'm a non-executive board member. And so it's a 30 to 40 person software company based in Redmond, Washington, and I'm still on the board. Still tinkering with OCR technology for other applications.
So how expensive were these machines at the time? I know when the early Kurzweil machines came out, I had one being a Xerox employee, and they were like $30,000 in the early 80s.
Yep. So our first scanner reader, the one that I did the demonstration to our board, it was a $40,000 device. I think at the time the Kurzweil products were 50 or 60. When we started Arkenstone, the Kurzweil reading machine had just dropped in price from about 20 to 10 to 12. And our claim to fame was by adding a Calera card to your existing talking PC that, you know, had a voice synthesizer and had a screen reader, we could deliver you a reading machine for under $5,000 additional. So we would sell you a Calera card and a scanner together for under $5,000. And that really broke a major price point barrier because over $10,000 was capital budget at a company. It was a huge amount of money for a family. Under $5,000, while still a lot, was something that a manager could sign for in a company and that families said, oh, that's less than a car. Let's, you know, let's buy this for our family member. Or employed blind people could actually realistically spend that money.
Right. So that was a big deal to leverage off of existing technology to bring the price point down to something affordable.
Yeah, and during the 11 years that we were Arkenstone, you know, that price went from 5 to 4 to 3 to 2.5 to 2 to 1,800 to 1,500 to 1,200 because, you know, it was a PC-based technology, you know. The coprocessor card went away and became software. The scanner went from being $1,000 or $1,500 to being $100. So we just knew, just because we're from the tech industry, just that the price would just erode. And the great thing about Arkenstone is as the prices fell, the number of people who could afford it went up, and our revenue stayed pretty steadily at, you know, sort of $5 or $6 million for almost a decade.
And now you can find that same technology in cell phones. We've come a long way in the past few decades.
So then at some point you sold that technology to Freedom Scientific and morphed the company into Benetech that does more social good entrepreneurship, whatever term you use for that.
Well, I would say that Arkenstone was the first example of that kind of a tech social enterprise. And we didn't know the term social enterprise or social entrepreneur. We were just, you know, engineers who thought this technology needed to be brought to market. But by the end of 1999, I was I was getting kind of bored, right? I'd had to put our talking GPS invention, Strider, on ice because we didn't have enough money because we were break even and we were diverting money from our reading machine product to build our talking GPS and our talking map, Atlas Speaks. And so when Dick Chandler, who's the founder of Freedom Scientific, came by the first time, he said, "So Jim, sell me Arkenstone." I said, "Go away, I'm a nonprofit." And then he came back a few months later and said, "Jim, tell me your aspirations." And I'm kind of a geek, so I didn't recognize that this is a negotiating ploy. And I did. I said, I have other products I want to build for blind people. I don't have any money. I have this idea of doing software for human rights groups. And so he said, "Well, how about I make you this deal? How about I give you $5 million, which, of course, since I'm running a nonprofit, doesn't go to me personally, but it's a budget. You and the engineers stay in the nonprofit. We will put 10 salespeople on selling your products instead of the 1.5 that you have. So more people will get your products. And you'll have the money to go off and start a couple new social enterprises." And so that's how we started Bookshare and our human rights program was using the money that we got from selling Arkenstone to Freedom Scientific.
Benetech is particularly well known and loved because of Bookshare, which you just mentioned. Can you talk a bit about how Bookshare got started?
The reason the idea came about was my teenage son, who was 14, was in a rock band with Chris Richardson, whose mom, Eileen Richardson, was starting a startup. So I came home one night, there was a new piece of software on the home computer, and I yelled at my kids, you're not supposed to download software from the internet. And my son Jimmy said, "I cannot tell a lie, Dad, it was me, but it's not from the internet, it's from Eileen, Chris's mom, who they live two doors down." And I said, "Oh, great. What company is she running that you're testing the software?" He said, "Well, it's called Napster." And I had never heard of Napster at this moment. And Jimmy and I sat down and spent an entire hour playing music. He was playing 90s punk. I was playing Pat Benatar, had music like that when I was your age. And at the end, I was willing to pay whatever price they name because having my 14-year-old son spend an hour with me was a miracle. And Jimmy said, "Oh, it's free." I said, "Oh, but of course, it's a beta, Of course it's free." He said, "But what's it going to cost when it's actually selling?" He said, "No, it's always going to be free, free, free." And I went, "Oh, this is so illegal, but it's so cool."
For people who may not have been alive during that period, you might explain quickly what Napster was.
So Napster's breakthrough was peer-to-peer music sharing. The idea that you would take all your music, which you had on CDs, you would rip it into an MP3 file onto your computer, and then you would share your entire library of songs with everybody else. So the cool thing was is that now any song that you might want, you could find it on Napster, download it, and play it without paying for it. So that was kind of the illegal part. But the peer-to-peer part was that the songs were actually hosted on everyone's sort of machine. And it was this real breakthrough to take advantage of the internet. And so my first idea looking at that was going, "Oh, wait a minute, I could build Bookster."
So that planted the seed for Bookshare.
Yeah. And so I went around and started, thinking about Bookster. And one of the first people I called was my lawyer. And I said, "Hey, look, we've got 40,000 Arkenstone users scanning the same books over and over again. When a new Harry Potter would come out, we knew that 2,000 families each spent 3 or 4 hours hand scanning Harry Potter. And then they each had their own OCR error filled version of Harry Potter. What if we scanned it once, proofread it? And then instead of just the 2,000 people willing to put in 3 or 4 hours each, maybe 10,000 people would be able to get that Harry Potter book, and maybe right away." And so he went off and did some legal research and came back a day later and said, "It's actually legal." I guess by this time, probably 4 years earlier, the Chafee Amendment had been passed, which made it legal for a nonprofit that wanted to help blind or print disabled people access books could scan or record or make into Braille any book without paying a royalty or getting permission. We actually had a straight-out copyright exception. So it was a great example of thinking about something that should be illegal that shouldn't.
Yeah, I guess those copyright rules being changed made a big difference to what blind people could access at the time. It really opened up a lot of doors for people.
Now, we all know Bookshare as Bookshare. You started talking about it as Bookster. I assume there's a story behind the name?
My lawyer and George Kirscher both beat me up over the name Bookster. because I'd already grabbed the domain and the word was already getting out in the blind tech community. Ah, Jim Fruchterman's going to start Bookster. It's going to be cool. But George and my lawyer both convinced me that the name would be a bad idea. It would irritate the publishers. And so we renamed it Bookshare to implement sort of this sharing value, because our idea of reinventing the traditional library for the blind and dyslexic was not that we would pick the books that blind people read, which is the way Library of Congress works, right? They have a limited budget. Librarians decide. Our idea was, if anyone in the community thought that book was worth scanning, it's worth sharing that with everybody else.
Where did you get the scanned books for Bookshare?
And we had a single blind guy, Paul Edwards, who at the time was the head of ACB, gave us 3,000 books at one go when we started Bookshare, because he'd been scanning a book a day of science fiction and fantasy. And so he made our collection for science fiction and fantasy in one fell swoop.
Wow, he was a busy man.
Yeah, I think he enslaved his family.
I guess.
And how many titles do you now have on Bookshare?
350,000.
That's a lot of books.
And we have 350,000 users.
That's a lot of users.
It has certainly come a long way. I remember when it first started and there weren't that many books available, although it certainly was, you know, some books that you couldn't get from other sources, which was nice. And many of the OCR errors were fixed, but not all of them. But these days, it's a lot better. And as you say, there's a ton more material available.
Well, I'm fully sighted, so I can't use Bookshare. But I remember when it first became available because I had one very happy husband.
So in the early days, as you pointed out, many people were scanning in their own material to share with others. But in the past many years, you've grown quite a bit and made a lot of arrangements with publishers to get their books in electronic format directly. So there isn't all that scanning issue. Are people still scanning in books at all, or is it all done electronically these days?
Yeah, we're still scanning in books. I'd say we're scanning 500 books a month, which is not all that different than what we historically used to scan. But what's different is, because some publishers were still worried about Bookshare being Bookster and leading to all sorts of bad things. And what happened was, 5 years went by, the world didn't end for publishers, the ebook industry took off, we weren't a source of pirated copies, and we were solving this problem that they weren't solving, right? I mean, many, many ebooks still come with digital locks that make them impossible to make them accessible. So what we did is we started going around and asking the publishers to give us the books. And so now we've got more than 500 publishers who give us essentially all their digital books, both their backlist of ones they've digitized and the ones as they come out. And so I think we've got 5 of the top 6 trade publishers in the U.S., many university presses. So now there isn't this need for people, for example, to scan New York Times bestsellers or major, you know, novels. Those we're probably getting from the publishers in beautiful, high-quality, you know, digital formats, the same ones that they're selling through Amazon and Apple. So the 500 books a month that we're scanning, I'd say the great majority are educational material, you know, the book that your teacher gave you the 8 books you need to read, and 6 of them are in Bookshare, but 2 of them aren't. You can ask us to go get them and scan them. And so they're mainly educational works, and they're mainly, relatively speaking, more obscure titles. We still have volunteers scanning in books, especially from publishers that, you know, resolutely refuse to cooperate with us. And, you know, the biggest one of those is Pearson. So Pearson's still a pretty big publisher, so we're still scanning a lot of their books.
If you want to hear more about Bookshare's impact on people around the world, including those without print disabilities, come back next week and we'll be talking about that then. For this week's final segment, we'll be talking about who qualifies for Bookshare books, how you can get and read Bookshare books, and how you can get more information, including how to sign up. In order to qualify, it's the same requirements as the National Library Service here in the U.S. and probably similar organizations in other countries. But basically, an expert must confirm that you have a print disability that prevents you from reading traditional print materials. And anybody in the world with a qualifying print disability is eligible to join Bookshare, whether or not it's a visual problem. So for all these people who want to read Bookshare books, you might be interested to know the wide variety of formats in which they are available. You can listen to them with high-quality text-to-speech voices. You can hear and see highlighted words on a screen. You can read them with digital braille or enlarged fonts. You can create physical braille or large print. You can read them directly from your internet browser and more.
And the place to go if you want to join Bookshare or volunteer for Bookshare is, of course, to their website, www.bookshare.org. And on their website, you'll see more descriptions about some of the applications they offer for reading in various formats. For example, you can download programs to be able to read these DAISY formatted books on your computer. There are applications for iPhone and Android devices to read books from Bookshare and download them directly from Bookshare. So there are a lot of resources on their site. And of course, you can get the form to fill out in order to join Bookshare. And it's a great service. I've been using it pretty much since their inception and have read hundreds of books. They also have lots of periodicals and magazines available for download. So if you're interested in the New York Times or even many of your local papers are there in the U.S., you can find those resources there. So check it out. There's lots of information.
So, Jim, if people want to learn more about Benetech and Bookshare, where would they go?
To find out more about Benetech and Bookshare and the Diagram Center, just type those domains into your search engine or search Google. There's a ton of accessible information for you to explore.
And do you want to give out your Twitter handle?
My Twitter handle is at Jim Fruchterman, all one word. J-I-M, F like Frank, R-U-C-H-T-E-R. M-A-N.
Well, thank you very much, Jim. This was great.
Thanks a lot, Pete. Thanks, Nancy.
Take care.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. And of course, the other places you can go to our website, www.eyesonsuccess.net. And in the show notes associated with every show, you'll find links to resources and information that you heard about in the show that maybe you didn't have time to write down. If you don't go to the show notes where we have all that written down each week, you can also use the search feature on our website to look for shows in our archive of over 200 episodes by either a show number, topic, or keyword. And you can find many episodes where we talked about Bookshare, Read to Go, a Bookshare app on the iPhone that lets you read Bookshare books, and other resources for reading books.
That's it for show number 1517. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be continuing the conversation with Jim Fruchterman about the worldwide impact of Bookshare, not just for people with print disabilities, and a number of other initiatives being pursued by Benetech. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net or call us at 585-258-0333.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman-Torpey and Peter Torpey and distributed by WXXI Reach Out Radio. For detailed information or a full archive of programs, visit www.eyesonsuccess.net. You can also follow us on Facebook and on audioboom.com at Eyes on Success or Twitter at @_EyesOnSuccess. We hope you will join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Eyes on Success and have a nice day.